The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
So welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Bob Heim. I'm chair of the Board of Trustees, and you should feel pleased about being here at what I think is the organization that is the greatest of our cultural institutions in this city. So here's the commercial. The commercial is that you should think about visiting our newly opened, reopened Philbrick popular reading room, where we have now expanded the book collection. There's a lot of new titles, a lot of new collections, and for the first time in at least recent memory, you can actually sit down and read because there's seating. And so I invite all of you to visit the Philbrick reading room, and I think you'll enjoy a beautiful new room, just absolutely beautifully renovated new room. And at the same time, you should consider going on the website, freelibrary.org. You won't have any trouble finding it. And on the website, you have access to a multitude of e-books and audiobooks and music and movies, all of which are available for you to download just with your library card. And while you're doing that, you might consider looking up the Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation and making a gift. A lot of what we're doing here at the library, this is a very dynamic, fast-moving institution, and a lot of what we're doing here is made possible by all of you, by donations, large and small, as we make this and continue to make this one of the greatest of this country's libraries. You know, somebody once said that a great city deserves a great library, and this is a great city, and we deserve a great library, and your contributions make that possible. Tonight, I'm honored to introduce Senator Arlen Specter. Senator Specter was, as many of you know, born in Wichita, Kansas, and moved east to attend the University of Pennsylvania, graduating in 1951. He served as Philadelphia's district attorney from 1966 to 1974, and then went on to become the longest-serving senator in Pennsylvania's history. In his new memoir, which is entitled, it's kind of got a long title, Life Among the Cannibals, A Political Career, A Tea Party Uprising, and The End of Governing as We Know It, Senator Specter shows how increased political extremism extinguishes any opportunity for moderate bipartisan agreement. Publishers Weekly reviewed the book and praised it and said, Life Among the Cannibals is as knowledgeable a critique of brutal partisanship in national politics as you'll find. But I can tell you even more than that in this book, what you see, and I've had an opportunity to read it, what you see is a man of principle who stood tall to do what he believed to be right, confronted by a milieu of extreme partisanship that elevates crass political maneuvering above the national interests. So we're delighted to have him with us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming my former partner, longtime friend, and friend of all Pennsylvanians, Senator Arlen Specter.
Thank you, Bob, for that generous introduction, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming this evening. For those of you who have heard me speak before, you know that whenever I begin a speech, I conspicuously take off my watch, look at it closely, to give my audience a false sense of security that, that I will pay attention to the time. Life Among the Cannibals is the title of the book. My preference was Cannibals Devouring Senators. But the publisher thought that this title with the subtitle would be better. And I articulated this theme in the last speech I made in the Senate at the end of 2010 when my term ended. And I decided to turn it into a book to try to acquaint the American people with what goes on behind the scenes and what the American people can do about it. The cannibals eat their young and they eat each other. And that is really what has been going on in Washington for some time. And I can be very specific. You have a very able senator like Bob Bennett in Utah, 93% conservative rating, not pure enough, he's beaten in the Utah primary for one vote, and I'll elaborate upon that. On the Democratic side, you have Joe Lieberman, superb senator, can't win a Democratic primary. Right now, Bob Kerry, former senator, is running in Nebraska, and he's being pilloried by the extreme left. Mike Castle in Delaware, outstanding member of the House for 18 years, governor of Delaware, runs against a woman who has to defend herself as not being a witch. And you really wonder which witch. And Castle, I hope you won't mind if I begin again. That's a standard comment. I've had an opportunity to use it repeatedly over the years. Bob Bennett voted for George W. Bush's TARP program, which was a bailout of the banks and the automotive industry. The country was on the edge of the economic ledge at the end of September, early October, and the House of Representatives voted down the $700 billion that President George W. Bush wanted to put up. So Vice President Cheney came to speak to the Republican caucus. And you know that wild-eyed liberal Dick Cheney. Well, he said, if the Senate doesn't pass this bill, George W. Bush will be turned into a modern Herbert Hoover. So 25 of 49 Republican senators voted aye. One of them was Bob Bennett, and that's why he lost his seat. One vote out of 18 years in the United States Senate. When President Obama came up with his stimulus package, it was the twin brother of what President Bush had done. Bush was $700 billion. Obama was $878 billion. And the Republican attitude was very different to Obama than to Bush. And before the ink was dry on the oath of office, in late January, DeMint of South Carolina was overheard to say, we're going to make this Obama's Waterloo. And McConnell, the leader of the Republicans in the Senate, said our legislative agenda is going to be to defeat Obama. This is 4 years out. Who ever heard of a legislative agenda to win an election for president? And the Republican caucus was intransigent. And Olympia Snow and Susan Collins and I thought it over and took the lead in providing the indispensable votes to pass the stimulus package. And I was convinced that the country was going to have a depression if we didn't do it. It was really just like TARP when we saved Bush after the stock market had tumbled 700 points. And I supported it, knowing full well that the political risks were enormous on it. And as it worked out in a series of events, it cost me my seat, as Bennett's vote on TARP had cost him his seat. Marie Field asked me, "Is there an answer?" And Joe Field echoed her question about where do we go from here? Well, there is an answer. And the answer rests in our democracy and rests on the people and rests on motivating enough people to restore the center to American politics. And there's a specific illustration as to how it was done and how it can be done on a broader scale. The senator from Alaska, Lisa Murkowski, was cannibalized. The Tea Party ran an opponent against her and a lot of money, and she was defeated. And she decided to have a write-in. Can you imagine having a write-in with a name like Murkowski? If you spell Murkowski with a Y instead of an I, your ballot's disqualified. If you spell it with a O instead of a U, your ballot goes out. And Lisa Murkowski beat the cannibals, led by DeMint of South Carolina. And after she had beaten them, they went to court. And DeMint came in to back his Tea Party buddy, advertised on his website for money, to put up a long legal battle, which Lisa Murkowski won again. And then there was quite a controversy in the Republican caucus about DeMint welcoming back his colleague, whom he had tried to cannibalize. Finally, he sent her a one-sentence telegram. I'm told, this is hearsay, I didn't see it. Congratulations, not even an exclamation mark. So the point is that if the voters are aroused and understand, they can be mobilized. And that's why I wrote the book, and that's why I'm trying to get people to read the book. The promotion of a book is really complicated. Don't have nice dinners like we had with the library board tonight and intelligence audience coming in. And the requirement that if you're here, you have to buy at least 3 books. I didn't hear too many laughs about that. You might get habeas corpus, but it's going to be tough to leave this place without. But I was on the telephone yesterday. You sit in a small room with a microphone, and every 10 minutes, you answer a radio station in Dubuque or Fargo, North Dakota, or Russell, Kansas, or someplace. And 18 of them in 3 hours is quite an exercise. And then some of it is a little more fun. You get to see Morning Joe and get to see Mika and that guy. That's a little better. The Supreme Court, regrettably, plays into the same mold which we have on partisanship in the Congress of the United States. And you see it in the arguments on the Affordable Health Care Act. And 4 of the justices have lined up and made their positions very clear on each side. The 4 horsemen of the apocalypse on the right have made their position clear, and the 4 liberals on the left have made their positions clear. And the one vote which could be swing is Kennedy. And I've watched Kennedy very closely. I have participated in the confirmation proceedings of 14 nominees for the Supreme Court, everyone who is on the court now and some who have come and gone, O'Connor and Souter and Rehnquist, et cetera. And Kennedy has an affinity for having the court called the Kennedy Court. And he just might see a way to embellish his reputation. In the opening of the argument on mandate, he seemed to be veering to the right when he said, if you can mandate buying health insurance, isn't that really the ultimate incursion on liberty? And then later in the afternoon, or morning, they don't work afternoons. Later in the morning, he said, well, who knows? If all of these uninsured people are getting their health care at emergency rooms, maybe there is a point here that it is not unreasonable to say they have to bear their own costs instead of passing it on to the rest of America. And we will see what he has to say. The court lives up to a comment made decades ago that the Constitution is what the Supreme Court says it is. But they change their tunes from the time they're being confirmed and testifying until they get those black robes on. Chief Justice Rehnquist wrote in one of the opinions on violence against women, they declared the statute protecting women against violence unconstitutional. 5-4 said that was a local problem. And Rehnquist said that he questioned Congress's, quote, method of reasoning, close quote. And I've asked every nominee since he said that, what transfixes the nominee when he sits in the Judiciary Committee room? Very cordial, very willing to please. From the time he walks across the green and puts his robe on and is on the Supreme Court, there's quite a change in attitude. And the Supreme Court has shown disregard for congressional fact-finding. The legislative process is supposed to work that Congress finds the facts. We have hearings. We find the facts. And that's the basis for legislation. And Roberts, in his confirmation testimony, said that if the court disregards congressional fact-finding, well, then they're really making the law. I didn't use the word usurpation, but was very close to it. And when he got to the court and Citizens United came up, totally disregarded 100,000 pages of evidence. And Alito did the same thing on the issue. And they both did the same thing on following precedents. Precedents are very stabilizing factors in law. If you follow a precedent, lawyers and people can figure out how to rely upon the law. And you can overrule a precedent, as the Supreme Court did in Brown versus Board of Education, Plessy versus Ferguson, changing equal protection of the law and desegregation. The values of society had changed totally. But in Citizens United, when the court decided that corporations and unions could make unlimited anonymous contributions, they disregarded the 100 years of precedent and two very recent Supreme Court decisions in coming to that conclusion. And the reality is that Roe versus Wade is in jeopardy. You'd think that that holding was set. It's been in existence since 1973, and there have been many, many chances for the Supreme Court to overturn it. But I believe if they add one more justice on the right, if Bork, for example, had been confirmed instead of Kennedy, Roe versus Wade would have long since gone. On Sunday, WHYY at 2:30 is going to have a program on a pilot which a group of us has produced, and it's on Citizens United. It's called Arlen Specter's The Whole Truth. You're entitled to your own opinions, but not to your own facts. And I've watched and participated in the Sunday talk shows for a long time and think that there needs to be some in-depth thinking. And the program is a combination of a Supreme Court argument and a Senate hearing. Brevity, to the point. And if you veer, you're interrupted and we move on. And I raised $100,000 for the pilot, and we're trying to put together the funding to carry on a 13-part series. But the core issue which commands my attention at the moment is this election. The presidential election always has center stage for obvious reasons, but no matter who is elected president, the government won't function unless there is a Congress which is not gridlocked. And where you have the extremes having taken control, members are afraid to deviate from the party line, by and large. Afraid to deviate because to do so will subject them to a primary challenge and a loss. So the Tea Party gang runs on a platform of no compromise. And that has produced the gridlock, and that has produced a dysfunctional government. Well, I'm up to the 20-minute mark. The rule is to speak 30 minutes, but I believe that a few souls are saved after 20 minutes, so the floor is yours. Yes, sir?
Looking back on the confirmation of Clarence Thomas, would you have done something different?
The core question in a confirmation hearing where Professor Hill testified was whether what happened between Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill was a disqualifier. We had the hearing in 1991, and the incidents occurred in 1981, and it was a case of he said, she said. Joan and I have arguments, rarely, but we have arguments. And a while after the argument, we can't remember what we were arguing about. That's not an uncommon characteristic. So how do you weigh the credibility of these two young people? We know what happened. We know what the facts are as to what happened after whatever occurred. They were working together in the Department of Education, and Thomas became chairman of EEOC, and Professor Hill was offered a job, and she followed him there. Then she went out to Oral Roberts University to teach law and invited Clarence Thomas to come speak, and she drove him to the airport. She visited him in Washington. They had telephone records of calls she had made, and it was my conclusion on that issue that Thomas was not disqualified on the basis of the hard facts, not being able to say what had happened in their conversations. The aspect of the questioning of Professor Hill was a very difficult matter, and I heard from many, many people afterward. I was involved in a tough election campaign. That happened in 1991. I was up for re-election in 1992. And many women and many men, too, said that they had almost felt they were on trial. Psychological transference. If the credibility of Professor Hill was challenged, well, was their credibility being challenged? So, it was for me a real learning experience as to what went on. As a result of that case, women's rights have been vastly improved in the workplace. Glass ceiling hasn't been broken yet, but there have been vast improvements. The kind of talk you find in the factories around America has changed substantially. I believe the questions I asked were professional and proper. I can tell you this, certainly much less vigorous than Bob Heim does on his cross-examination, or I used to do when I was an assistant DA and prosecuting Teamsters and other thugs. And I believe Lynn Yackel went over those hearings. They're all available, frame by frame. And had she found one where I was out of line, you would have seen a lot of television advertising, and there was none. Sorry to give you such a long answer, but that's a very involved question. Yes?
Hi, Senator Spector. Julie Harris-McRae. Senator Spector, you're talking about the cannibalism that goes on in Washington, and I was there outside the caucus when Dick Cheney came, but I'm thinking about what's going on with the presidential election today, and I don't think that there's a lot of direct honesty about what really goes on. Yes, the rights of women have somewhat improved, because what happens in this country makes sure what happens. If so goes the U.S., so goes the rest of the world. But look at the leadership of both the Democratic and Republican Party. This is a patriarchal leadership from the base of it. You know, everything is based upon a designated person. I mean, I like Bob Brady personally as a person, but he's a party boss. If Bob stamps you and Bob runs it, you're in. We've had some qualified candidates that should have been jurists, should have been judges, but they were not one of his cut buddies or John Doherty's. You are an experienced, very qualified senator. You were in the battle for your life. Why? Why did that happen? Because we have both parties that do not trust the judgment of the American people. They dictate by spin. They dictate by innuendo. They dictate with party bosses and designated candidates. Don't you think, if anything, Rick Santorum has turned this over on its head by challenging the presumptive candidate for once, even though I don't agree with everything he does. When he was a senator here in Pennsylvania, he did a lot of good things, and I supported him, as I did you. I was a registered Democrat. Don't you believe that it's about time we stop having designated candidates and we get rid of this patriarchal party boss system that we have?
Well, Bob Brady did not pick federal judges. Federal judges were picked through a process where John Hines and I, and then Harris Wofford and I, and so forth, had a bipartisan panel which made recommendations. And then senators make the final recommendation on district court to the president. And on the Judiciary Committee, I saw to it that there were no vacancies in Pennsylvania, and that the people nominated and confirmed were of the highest caliber. And Jerry Shestack, who was president of the Bar Association, said that the Pennsylvania bench, and especially the Eastern District bench, which I knew the best, being a Philadelphia lawyer, was first rate, was exemplary. When it comes to bosses picking the candidates, they can be overthrown. I wanted to be a district attorney, and I wanted to run on the Democratic ticket. Fairly well known as to my roots being Democratic, my father was an advocate for Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And I won a lot of big cases, put the Teamsters in jail and cleaned up the magisterial system and was on the Warren Commission staff. And Joe Clark, then the senator, recommended me to be the Democratic nominee. And I went to see the party boss, Frank Smith. And he said, "We don't want a young Tom Dewey in the district attorney's office, young man." There are some people here who remember Tom Dewey. And that was that. You were right. The party boss picked the candidate. The Republicans came to me and said, "We haven't won an election in a long time. We think for what you've done, you just might be able to win." I thought it over and decided I had no future with boss Frank Smith and the system they had in this town and the Democratic Party. The corruption, the grand jury found a sinister connection between the sale of zoning legislation and Democratic City Committee. And I ran an uphill fight and won as a registered Democrat on the Republican ticket. And then I decided to become a Republican to try to bring a two-party system back in Philadelphia, which this city urgently, urgently, urgently needs to this minute. And I thought there wasn't any Democratic or Republican way to prosecute criminals. And then I decided I wanted to run for statewide office. It took me three primaries to win a primary. Finally, in 1980, the Republican voters disliked my opponent more than they disliked me. That's a true story. Don't get many out of Washington, but that's a true story. And I was elected, and I was in the Republican caucus and thought I could do more good in the Republican caucus than in the Democratic caucus, be a different voice. And when Bradford Reynolds came up to make him associate attorney general, he had falsely testified on some civil rights cases, and I led the fight against him. Then Bork came up, and I led the fight against Bork. We're having a 25 years retrospective of Bork next week in Washington, and I'm speaking. And then Republicans were very unhappy with me all along. When I cast the stimulus vote, there was no way I could win a Republican primary. Toomey, whom I had beaten narrowly in 2004, had announced for governor. He was not going to run for Senate again. So I had a clear shot, but I knew if I voted for the stimulus, it was very, very risky. Biden, meanwhile, had been trying to persuade me for a long time. We rode the train together. You know, Washington, Baltimore, Wilmington. Occasionally, I got to say something. But usually not until the train had left Wilmington. And Ed Rendell, whom I had given his first job to out of law school, along with Mike Bailson, who's now a distinguished judge, speaking about quality people on the federal bench. He was also a quality U.S. attorney, and he was a quality assistant DA. And I decided I wanted to continue the work I was doing on judgeships, fine federal bench we have now. Bob Heim told me earlier this evening there are six vacancies that the senators have not gotten off a dime to make recommendations to the president. And do you know what a recommendation is worth in April or March of a presidential election year? Hopeless. Hopeless. And I wanted to carry on the funding for NIH. I took the lead in increasing NIH funding from $12 to $30 billion. Today, there's not a champion for NIH in the Congress. And instead of adding $2, $3 billion a year, which happened while I was the chairman of the subcommittee, they now, it's cut, went down $318 million last year. It takes a billion just to tread water. But you can take it away from the bosses if you work at it. I did. And if you're independent, and if you duplicate what Lisa Murkowski did, you can put the center back in American politics. Yes, sir. And then I'll take the lady behind me.
My name is Bruce Green, and I just wanted to know what were your thoughts when you met, I believe you met Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.? What were were your thoughts when you met Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.? I believe you did meet him in your tenure.
The gentleman's asking what your thoughts were when you met Martin Luther King Jr.
I thought he was a great man. I thought he was a symbol. He'd already made the I Have a Dream speech. Met him at the home of Harry and Joy Taicoff in East Falls on a Sunday afternoon. I was running for DA. It was August of 1965. And I said, Dr. King, how do you think we curtail police brutality? Frank Rizzo was had pearl-handled guns at that time and was making a lot of arrests and had a blackjack in his cummerbund. And he said, you got to have a civilian review board. And I made it a point to campaign on that issue and have one. I made the first arrest of policemen for brutality, I believe, nationwide that time. And when we took up the issue of a holiday for Dr. King, Jesse Helms was blasting him as a communist and as a womanizer. And I got the floor and told about the Dr. King I knew. You might think we've had a Martin Luther King Day forever, but it's only since 1983 that that legislation was passed. Lady behind? Yeah.
My question is, party bosses, that's one person. I've spent the last 10 years in California, so I was out there watching you get defeated and in astonishment. I was sitting with my parents saying, how in this state could the people not keep their most senior senator who has the most power to bring in to this state money, everything? And an election is not just a boss voting, it's a state voting. When you were living in Pennsylvania and you were viewing it from another state, which I was in California, I wondered what happened in this state that they would unseat you. And I understand the power of money in commercials, but it's a basic elementary school civics lesson. You don't throw away your senior senator.
I have your question, and probably the reason I lost was that you weren't here to campaign for me. of the vote turned out in that primary election. I wasn't liberal enough for the Democrats. I wasn't conservative enough for the Republicans. And behind the scenes, and I go into it in some detail in my book, when I made the switch, I got an explicit promise from Harry Reid, the Democratic leader, that I would retain my seniority. And I don't mince any words anywhere in the book. He double-crossed me. And when you run in the primary and you don't have 30 years seniority, what distinguishes you from the other guy? Orrin Hatch is being attacked by the cannibals, as is Dick Lugar. It looks like Lugar's going to go down. Great senator. And it looks like Hatch is going to survive because of his seniority. May become chairman of the Finance Committee. Seniority means a lot. And I didn't have it. And that was a key factor. Next question? Yes, sir. Then I'll take you, sir. Okay.
Senator Specter, this has been wonderful. I'm certainly enjoying this. I've certainly enjoyed your talk here. My question to you is, there have been a number of experts dealing with the assassination of President Kennedy who have espoused the crosshairs assassination between two or three assassins. You've always espoused the Wonder Bullet theory. I wonder, do you still hold to that?
I do. The evidence which is set forth in detail in my first book, Passion for Truth, I wrote that book in the year 2000, because I've had so many questions at high schools and colleges and on the street. People stop and ask me the question. And I wrote it all down, and the evidence was conclusive about the single bullet theory. Bullet had a strange path, but sometimes truth is stranger than fiction. Oswald was conclusively the assassin. There again, the evidence is all detailed. It would take too much time to go into it now, and you can find it in Passion for Truth. On the issue of was there a conspiracy, you can never prove a negative. If you want to prove that Joan Spector was at the library auditorium on March 29th, you have to have a witness or two who saw her there. You want to prove she wasn't, you got to have this place under surveillance for 24 hours. But the commission found there was no evidence of a conspiracy. And I believe had there been a conspiracy, it would have come to light a long time ago. Nothing important stays secret in our society. When I met Fidel Castro, Joan and I visited him on several occasions, and I got to know him a little, and I decided to ask him a big question. I said, there's been a lot of talk about Oswald being put up to the assassination by you. Oswald was on the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, and we know the CIA made several assassination attempts against Castro. I said, Mr. President, were you involved in the assassination of President Kennedy? And he said, I'm a Marxist, not a fool. And I thought to myself, well, you could be both. That's in the book. And some things in the book are more interesting than that, like being in the Fast Talk Express with John McCain and Sarah Palin, very cramped quarters, knee to knee and all the rest of that stuff. And I don't want to go into any detail with so many women here, but buy the book. Sarah Kay.
Senator, I have two questions. One really relates to the question about the bosses and how they rule, the political bosses and how they rule. I think this audience would be very interested in how you turned around the district attorney's office when you became DA and how you absolutely refused to take orders from any political boss. I find that story very riveting. And in addition, I know all we miss that you're not in the Senate and why, but I'm wondering what you miss the most and perhaps what gives you the most relief about not being there.
Well, the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office was a patronage haven when I came, part-time, very ineffective. Judges came to work. They're supposed to work from 10 to 12:30 and 2 to 4, which is not a big work day. And they would arrive about 10 minutes to 11, quit about 12:05, come back about 2:40, and quit at 3:10. So I sent detectives into the courtrooms to write down the time. And soon a detective called up and said, I've been held in contempt of court, Arlen. You got to do something for me. So I went back down to the courtroom, and I said, Judge, you can't hold him in contempt of court. He's acting under my orders. If you hold anybody in contempt, you have to hold me in contempt. And you can't hold anybody in contempt. This is open court. We can write down anything we like. And the detective and I walked out free men. And there were merit appointments. Again, I'll identify Mike Bailson. I would identify Sarah Kay's then husband. Bailson was he was a Democrat, and I announced 10 appointments, one of whom was a woman, in the days when Sandra Day O'Connor worked as a law clerk, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg couldn't get a lawyer's job. I was hiring women in the DA's office. And they called up all 10 of the assistants to the families. Mike Bailson's father answered and said, how's your son registered? He's a Democrat, but he'll change. But I didn't care what his registration was. I hired people for quality and for merit. And I pressed the judges on sentencing. And I pressed on realistic rehabilitation. Mayor Good's here this evening, and he's working with children of convicts. And we had a program called pre-indictment probation that Alan Davis had to divert 7,500 cases out of 30,000 a year. Became a national model. It's called ARD in Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania Rules of Criminal Procedure. Do I miss the Senate? Sure. Sure. What do I miss most? I'm not there with that platform to speak out on these issues, but I'm finding other ways to do it. The book, I teach a course at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. I have this TV program, which I'm trying to develop into a series. I've tried for about 25 years to get the Supreme Court televised, and I haven't succeeded yet. Twice my legislation has gotten out of committee, but it's never come to the floor. And I probably only have 20, 25 more years to get that done. And I'm now developing some followers in the law school class. I want to get some people who carry on that work if I don't succeed in the next 25 years. Anybody got an easy question? With the gentleman there, and then I'll take the gentleman from the center.
Do the leaders of the Republican Party really believe that the American people are as stupid as the candidates are making them out to be?
The question was, does the Republican Party really think that the American people are as stupid as the candidates are making them out to be? Yes. Who has the next question?
Thank you for taking my question, Senator. Do you feel that Fox News has contributed significantly to the rise of the Tea Party and fuels them to this day?
What contributing?
Fox News.
Fox News?
Contributes to the Tea Party.
Yeah, I think that talk radio and talk television contribute to the partisanship on both sides. If you're a moderate as a newscaster, you don't do very well in broadcasting today. But I do think that, and all the money and the 30-second ads and the gotcha ads have all coalesced to make the political climate in 2012 very different. And this gentleman's right. The American people are not stupid. The people of Alaska are not stupid. And if the American people understand what's at stake, and I think there's a good chance this time. You've seen the approval ratings, 8%. People understand that nothing's happening in a gridlock Congress, and I think they may throw all the rascals out. The gentleman on the nearest the wall, then I'll take the gentleman to his left.
Senator Spector, I'd like to applaud you for your integrity, for your time in office. My question is, what are the long and short-range impacts of the closures of the military facilities in Philadelphia and regionally, especially the Navy Yard?
Well, the long-term implications are that we have to find other work. And I fought the Navy Yard case to the U.S. Supreme Court. I personally filed a lawsuit against the Secretary of the Navy and argued the case in the Supreme Court. I lost the case because the Supreme Court would have had to have overturned 300 base closings to save the yard, but the Navy didn't tell the facts that the experts said the yard should remain open, although downsized. But I brought a lot of money to the yard, $50 million from the Department of Labor, and more than that from the Department of Defense, and funding so that place is almost as flourishing now as it was in the past. And the defense budget has to be cut. It's a different world, and we ought not to be in Afghanistan. I spoke up against putting 30,000 additional troops. I think we have no business in Afghanistan. We've got to marshal our resources a lot more carefully. The Iraq war was a big mistake. But Colin Powell came back from the CIA and said they had weapons of mass destruction, and the Congress relied upon that. Here you had a man who had been chief of staff of the Army, national security counselor, secretary of state, a big man. And if you couldn't find out from the CIA, I would understand that. But to come back and tell us something which was untrue, I don't think he did it deliberately, but it was just as costly to be mistaken. Gentleman right next to him.
Well, hi, Senator. It's good to see you again. I was just wondering if you look back at your long career of running many campaigns at the local, state, and national level, who would you say was your toughest opponent and why?
Well, I hate to choose among people I'm not too fond of to to give them credit. Pressed for an answer, and I like to answer questions, I'd choose Pete Flaherty. Pete Flaherty was the first opponent I had in 1980. He'd been the mayor of Pittsburgh, and I'll choose Pete Flaherty.
Senator, we can take two more questions.
How about answers? Okay, whoever wants to ask a question can. Two more, but as you know, there's no time for answers. Yes, sir. I think the questions are all gone. There may not be two more questions.
I've heard that the United States has the largest prison population in the world. And I'm wondering, are we putting too many people in prison? I wonder what you think about that.
I think that there are a lot of people in prison who ought not to be there. They have a big population of crack cocaine, and it's being directed against African Americans because those are the folks who use it. And there's been some. I tried to change it drastically. Finally, it's been changed a little, and I think that will be helpful. We have never made an investment on realistic rehabilitation, which I have advocated since I was DA, literacy training and job training so that people come out, don't go through a revolving door. And Joe Biden and I introduced the Second Chance Act, which George Bush signed into law to give people a second chance. I think there are a lot of things that can be done to cull out. I believe in life sentences for career criminals. And by a career criminal, I mean someone who's committed three or more violent crimes. And I authored legislation to that effect. But we could reduce the prison population substantially, safely.
Senator,
Joe Field had his hand up. We're going to violate the moderator's rule and give Joe a last chance.
What's that?
Go ahead.
Okay. Senator, you have known and worked.
Are you listening to my wife and formulating this question? Why are you blushing?
Had I done so, I think it would be better than what I'm about to ask. But you have known and worked closely, or certainly worked with some of the people that folks in the Democratic Party are most upset with. Let's say McConnell, let's say Jim DeMint. Putting the most charitable view on what is motivating them, not to just say they're bad people or they're stupid people or they're venal people. What kind of credit can you give to the thinking that motivates where they're coming from?
I cannot give McConnell any credit. Hey, let's identify the problem. Let's be candid about it. I worked with McConnell since 1984 when he was elected. I'd been in the Senate 3 years. I know McConnell very well. And when he has as his legislative agenda the defeat of the president, I can't give him any credit for that. And when DeMint backs Tea Party candidates against Murkowski and against Castle, and they take on Bennett, he wants Ivory Snow at 99.4 for us, not pure enough for DeMint. And I don't mince any words in the book in terms of identifying where the problems are. And I think people have to understand it so people will act on it. And there are some intelligent people in Kentucky where McConnell comes from. I'm not so sure about South Carolina where DeMint comes from. Sheldon Adelson bought South Carolina for Newt Gingrich for $10 million. I think Adelson overpaid. Joe, you got the last word. Joe and I were college debating partners. We were undefeated.
Alan, I'm going to ask you the same question I asked you upstairs because I think it's so basically important, and that is there a way, short of war, to prevent Iran from getting the atomic bomb?
You don't expect me to change my answer, do you? I think there is. And my view is that we will avoid the war. The sanctions are biting deeply. And they have found some sanctions on the international banking laws, which hadn't been talked about until recently. And they're biting deeply. And Russia and China are on the sidelines. They're not joining with the UN on the sanctions. But as we progress, I think you'll see more help from Russia and China. I think everybody wants to avoid a war. And I think we will find a way to do it, realizing the terrible consequences of a war. As I said upstairs, when Ehud Barak, the defense minister, former prime minister, whom I have a lot of respect for, had that dynamite interview with the New York Times 5-6 weeks ago, I think it was a calculated psychological warfare thrust on his part. And I think Iran knows that Israel means business, and so does the United States. And I think every effort will be made to avoid a war, but Israel is likely to have devastating, terrible casualties, and who knows where it will go. So that I believe that sanity will prevail even with Iran. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.